The Queerness of Eve, Book One. This poem has an epigraph from Marianne Baruch's Endurer's engraving. And that epigraph is pre-unbearable. The Queerness of Eve, Book One. A rib wife's birthright, anxiety of influence, and some guy's leech kiss. No choice but yes, when there's a world to be blooded. Birth was painless at first, but my lady bits still turned into an inside-out fig. Say apple used to mean all fruit, but say no language yet. Say, therefore, conversational in silence. That's how it went. Imagine small talk when the weather's perfect. Imagine how quick he came the first time man had sex. You probably guessed I created the female orgasm all by my lonesome. Where did the time go? Can I say I wasted it watching the boring anachronisms rutting in a clearing before I came upon two swollen bonobos legging furiously as if their blades were dull, as if they invented gravity that could pull down stars. I've seen Nobas fall from the garden's ramparts, seen the tsunamis they make of the primordial soup. I was always hungry for something the garden couldn't tender, knowledge strip-teasing like a poppy, some blousy flower. So I waited. I watched blue-blooded Adam sleeping soundly as a trust fund, studied his asymmetrical bone ladder. I thought then to take the lower ribs mirror to make someone else from him for me. Hand sweaty, I gripped a talon I swiped from a dead condor, its great wings like a book left open by an interrupted scholar. But Adam awoke into his strength, yawning out his morning stink, and I twisted the talon into my hair to hold it out of my eyes. Focus now. Woman always settled on me like snow on warm ground. Briefly, some may fly tender. But my body's weirder than archetype, more pulsed than perfection. If I had been marble, I would have lost interest. Who says Adam's manlier? Who became my nickname for God? I also called him when, what, and where. Why just the two of us? Why does Adam have nipples if he can't provide for his children? How do I unsilly a never-asked question? How do I make silence my gender? Book 6. My brain expanded like yeast dough proofing in a covered bowl. I began on my hands and knees, but soon slouched like a... Eventually, my spine was as straight as the definition narrow. And God shook out the pterodactyl like a wet umbrella. Inside out, it became the mute swan. I didn't dare feed it crumbs from my open palm, but I watched it double S over the wellspring pond, and this was the first moment I realized there could be more than one of anything. The swan and the anti-swan in symmetry, imperfect only for the ripples glassing away from its body. God made man in his own image, so they say. So I made a beloved in mine. Book 9, and the epigraph comes from Mahmoud Darwish's State of Siege, translated by Fadi Judah. And it reads, if it weren't for the sins, the holy book would have been smaller. Book 9. The tree I found on a hill crown crusted with daffodils that always annoyed me, all beak, too cheery. I only only meant to take the shade as the world was still fresh from the bake, its morning breath Santa Ana'd in, hot and smelling of sulfur and smoked cheese. Still, I rested there. The apocalypse was coming sooner or later, and I'd need my energy to survive my survival, its unending variations on a theme, the serpentine chromatics of blame. I unwrapped my fig and chev sandwich, redacting the minutes, bite by bite, shape bite, until she unfolded herself from the blistering noon light, split into three dimensions by a prism of want. And then she looked at me as if we shared an inside joke and let down her hair, which was shadow, which was life death. I was so surprised I forgot to show, don't tell. I forgot my name means just before night, the night before day. I burned yes like sage on the tongue of flame in my mouth. But the fruit I plucked, it was peach flesh, muscled in my cage.
Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Off Poetry Podcast with the poet Amelia Phillips. Amelia Phillips has just been reading from their new book, Nonbinary Bird of Paradise, out now from University Akron Press. Amelia Phillips, They, Them, Theirs, is the author of four previous poetry collections from the University of Akron Press, including Embouchure, 2021, and five chapbooks. Their poetry, creative nonfiction, and book reviews have appeared widely. They are an associate professor of creative writing in the Department of English, MFA in Writing Program, and the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at UNC Greensboro. Hello and welcome, Amelia.
Hi, Han. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk about your new book. And I mean, you are a much beloved poet, very much missed on Twitter. And I just... I posted like, oh, I'm recording an episode with Amelia Phillips, and a bunch of people were just like, Amelia Phillips, we miss them. And I was like, I know. So
wait, this happened on Twitter?
Yes.
Oh, damn. I thought it was like, you know, like I would have retroactive pitchforks coming for me, like no. The monster in the castle.
No. And I don't visit that space very often. I haven't for months. But I did get on to like post about Of Poetry just because we just reached 10,000 downloads. And I was like really excited that like a little passion project can go someplace.
That's so exciting that you got 10,000 downloads. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for being on the show. I mean, I just wanted you to know that like people really love and miss you, and you're such a generous giving presence and an amazing reader. And I also think it's really important that people recognize like when queer artists don't feel safe in a space anymore and they leave it, which is why I'm largely not there, because trans comments and transphobia hits different when you're non-binary trans. It's like, no, I'd rather feel safe. I'd rather have peace of mind.
Two thoughts I have here is, one, I love that we're still calling it Twitter. I think just the best. I think we should forever call it Twitter, no matter what billionaire buys it and changes its name. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it is true that, you know, certain forms of social media can be detrimental to mental health. And you're absolutely right that, especially as I began exploring gender identity and those sorts of things, that was a space that didn't feel particularly safe, in part because it is so open to everybody, especially when you're in a non-private account. And, you know, it's just such a public way to live one's life. And I'm okay with that, you know, like in general. But, you know, when I really had to dig deep into some of those like gender, sexuality things in my own personal life, it just didn't feel safe to be in a more vulnerable area like Twitter.
Yeah. And we think a lot, I know, about audience and who you're speaking to. And there's a real lack of control and And I think some people find that like wildly exciting, and it can also be anxiety inducing and all kinds of things. I'm here for people doing what feels best for them and their work. And I'm grateful we can still find, you know, I can go to the book fair. I can find your book at the University of Akron's table. Like I can see Mary Binninger. I can like talk, you know, that there are avenues. It's not all purely online. It's not all purely. It can feel that way, but it's not for sure. Like, and community isn't.
I am on Instagram, I will note.
Awesome.
At m-phillips, two L's in Phillips. No underscores, no spaces. But, you know, that for me has been a much more kind of like, it's been a space where I felt more kind of community than, because I think there it's limited to more of the kind of like writers and thinkers and librarians. I love librarians so much. I just want to give a shout out to librarians at any point, you know, that I'm following, and, you know, having those kinds of like engagements, I think are much more important to me and help me feel connected to the writing community. I think I don't know the exact date I left Twitter. It was kind of a rash decision and did not regret it whatsoever. But I was like, that must have happened fall 2019. Did that happen then? I don't know. But I know it preceded the pandemic in a way that did kind of exacerbate feelings of like, I'm not connected to the literary community outside of my immediate literary community here in Greensboro, North Carolina, and not even so much with those folks, because we're all social distancing. And so I do think that social media operates as a great way for all of us to kind of connect in that community space. But I don't, the Scrabble or the smaller thing happen, you know, to tell me one time, there's so little at stake in poetry. And so everybody's much more fiercely fighting for it. And so for me, it's just all about community and wanting to find that community and writers want to create alongside or in conversation with.
Absolutely. And for me, it's, you know, like the idea of local community is so important. And I mean, it's interesting because like as a semi-hermit, I connect with people online, and I love those avenues of like written communication and book recommendations and
is that
access.
How I met you online?
I think so.
I know. I remember one specific moment where we met early on, but I don't know if that was our first kind of interaction, but I'm pretty positive we were kind of connecting online in some way before that.
I mean, we're forever bonded as like poets who've taken a cemetery graveyard tour together. So,
and it was so hot when we did.
Like melting. I know. It was so
hot. I mean,
you
so be sweatier than 99% of people on Earth. So
we were all drenching. It's, you know, I don't
know.
Of
a blood pact. It's like a sweat pact that you've seen.
It's real. It's real. Poets and cemeteries. I just, so right. Well, I'd love to talk more about your poems, and thank you so much for reading those gorgeous Eve poems. I find it such exciting, awesome work, and there's so many good things. I'd love to talk for a minute about the form and you choosing to write them in like the variable line free verse. Mm-hmm. For me, I often think of your work as you write beautiful stanzas. You're very much, for me, I see you in the line of like Linda Gregerson or like Tersette. So I thought it was so interesting to see that shift for Eve's voice. And I just was wondering if you wanted to talk about that some.
I would love to talk about that. And first of all, super honored to compared to Linda Gregerson, whose work I admire so much, and whose stanzaic structures are some of my favorites. I think in a book review years ago, I described her stanzas. This was for Prodigal, the new and selected. I think it came out. What's time after the pandemic? Maybe 5-7 years ago, something like that. I described her stanzas as like chandelier forms, almost kind of like, now that I'm thinking about it, like Calder sculptures that are kind of hanging from this like center point at the top, and then everything else is gravity. So I'm very honored to be compared to Linda Gregerson, and I often encourage my students to read her work. So thank you so much for noticing also that there's been a movement toward the left margin in the Eve poems, excluding the last in the sequence of the 12 poem sequence. And I'm happy to talk about that form as well. There was something for me about the movement to the left-hand margin that was reminiscent of the dramatic monologues that we're used to in a very, let's say, European tradition of poetry. And I just want to, you know, give a shout out to Vivi Francis, who many years ago at Breadloaf, I think this is 2013, challenged a faculty member to think about, instead of the tradition of poetry, traditions of poetry. So I want to be very, very clear that I'm working within a very narrow scope of those traditions. But I was also teaching a lot of line breaks in my graduate classes in particular that just at their very core, I was just very interested in what the unit of the line itself means in relationship to the unit of the sentence, whether that is a complete grammatical unit or it's a sentence fragment. And a lot of times I do move off that left margin. I might be using like terraced tercets. I think that's a Dana Levin idea or image, that there's some kind of terracing of those tercets, but I believe that's where I got that metaphor from. But, you know, movement off that left margin to create a sense of movement or instability. But here I was just very interested in just highlighting the relationship between the line and the relationship of the sentence. And I think, you know, if anybody wants to get really nerdy, they can jump in and, like, you know, separate out every single line and let me know if they see a difference between the meaning of the line and the sentences to which they belong. And adding the additional artifice of movement off the left margin, I think, calls attention to some more visual aspects of the poems that I didn't necessarily want. And in some ways, as Eve progresses, just content-wise in the poems, she becomes a creator. And I think there's less artifice, especially in her earlier poems, and why we kind of, in the final poem, the 12th poem, we see this kind of like complete rejection of the left margin as her operative position. And so she's kind of had everything kind of demystified for her, also suffered the consequences of that demystification. And now she can kind of move away from that kind of like left-hand margin, which I also kind of think of as like, particularly in languages read left to right, that is a kind of, how do I put this? It's a kind of, I don't want to say chokehold. It is a kind of arbitrary distinction that one could potentially connect to larger issues around form and format in poetry. What is received as quote unquote good poetry by the institutions that have the power to validate what is quote unquote good poetry, or have historically validated that as such. Of course, we have earlier examples of poets who are very much a part of the westernized European canon that are moving away from that left margin. I mean, I think of, you know, Herbert's Temple, right? Like in the altar poem, or is it called Wings? Easter Wings, thank you, yeah. So we do have that kind of movement away from there, but I do think that as I was exploring through these poems, I really wanted Eve, kind of in a subtle way, to move away from something that has been handed to her as quote unquote the norm or compulsory, right? And move into something that is purely of her design. And that's where we see the 12th poem arrive, because the poem is all about compulsory sexuality and how the Garden of Eden of narrative, which exists across many religions, and I'm certainly by no means anti-religious, I just wanted to challenge the ways in which heterosexuality can be kind of embedded into these narratives. maybe give us an opportunity for reflection on that and how much that might shape one's life or what they've internalized about their own sexuality or gender.
Yes. Thank you for that. I think that's amazing. And I was being quiet when you were speaking about the left-hand margin because I didn't want to put like the language I was thinking of for it. Like, I was like, oh yeah, the tyranny of the left side of the page, or like the hierarchy, or like, you know, I didn't want to like shove that out there necessarily. But I mean, it's really cool to think about the field of the page, right? And yeah. Eve exploring her selfhood on the page. And I find like the idea of Eve using a nonce form, I think is really cool. And being like, what am I? Like, you know, I'm not heroic couplets. I'm not blank verse. I'm not, you know, I'm not all these things. And, you know, for me, I don't love the binary, but there's something artless or something exploratory about Freeverse. It feels very, there's like a Anne Sexton period that it kind of calls to for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it brings up like Penelope's chapter in James Joyce, Ulysses for me too, mm-hmm. which is like this one rushing heady sentence where it's like, and it's problematic, right? Because it's like, oh, look, here's the artless female. Here's the, so in Joyce, it's interesting. It's people have written lots and lots of essays and scholarship on this artlessness. That's also an art, right? And it is artifice. So what does the artifice look like? Like what shape does it take is kind of just a wonderful place to go into with Eve, but.
And not to interrupt, I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking, you know, of the way in which Freeverse, you know, itself at this point is not necessarily like, you know, a complete freedom for a character that's speaking like that. It still has its own rules, quote unquote, rules of engagement. I think that's also something, you know, when you're teaching poetry, you're teaching poetic form or structure or theory or craft or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, that's something that it's hard to teach. It's like, it's free verse, but all these other things are kind of like at work and at play behind it. And there's this idea that, you know, for me that really connected it really well with the Garden of Eden of like, you know, Adam and Eve have free will, but they're still restricted in some capacity. And that's really for me where the content and the format kind of come together in those poems.
And the amount of learning we have to do as writers and poets, like the amount of learning and then unlearning, I think comes up for me a lot. And I was actually wondering if you would be open to reading your poem, Anti-Domestic.
Oh yeah, absolutely. May I provide a little info about this?
Yes, please.
Okay, cool. And what page is it on? Don't put me singing in the podcast. Hold on. I mean, I literally just got this book like 2 weeks ago. So, here we go. Okay, so I wrote this poem in a kind of critical moment in understanding my own sexuality. The gender part is less available here, but for me, it's very much under the surface of the poem. Some of the things that I was thinking about as I approached the writing of Anti-Domestic are the ways in which I was given some pretty misogynistic viewpoints toward poetry by an early teacher. I'll just say an early teacher. And some of those cross the line into inappropriate behavior, and which one will see at the end of the poem. So it has sort of two scenes, the more present scene, and then a later kind of reflection upon a lesson I received from a poetry teacher. Anti-Domestic. The night before, a sleeping bag on the floor, body aches in a constellation of gravity. All my things gone to another city with him, except my desire.
She came in the morning with coffees, the half and half split and floating. We talked about our husbands, the island between us. I knew if I moved closer to her, I would move closer to her. But language performed its function. We said what we wanted by not saying it, circling it as if it was a fire. This was before we were against the wall in the laundry room, where I once and many times lifted his wet clothes, heavier than they had seemed, than they had been before, and darker, from washer to dryer. Her leather jacket creaking as she raised her arms to pull my hair. A teacher once had me write a poem about something that wasn't sexy, in a sexy way. Washing dishes, doing laundry. The rest of my life, I have been unlearning.
Thank you. Yeah. I just find that such an important poem in the book, and beautiful and surprising. And like, there are lines that I, you know, in my brain, I was like, in the laundry room where I once and many times, and my, I don't know, that's my horny brain, but I was like, oh my God. And then it's like lifted his wet clothes, you know? And so, yeah, I love the idea of the domestic and the anti-domestic, and the way, you know, the institutions of learning also get into our lives.
I mean, a laundry room can be sexy.
Yeah.
Let's admit that. I think this is, you know, it's also because I'm Cancer, Sun, Aries, Moon, that I'm like stuck between the domestic and the anti-domestic. Mm-hmm. So
fair.
Why is it so fake? Why is astrology so fake when it's so real? That's what I want to know.
Because it's very old knowledge. It's very old. I don't really think we should fuck around with the stars. I'm like, you know what? They said that. They. I've probably mentioned this before, but my favorite novelist, Iris Murdoch, is a Cancer.
And it's I didn't realize Murdoch was a Cancer.
Yeah. And oh, dang, Cancer is on like the emotional life and reading others and whoo. Mm, so good.
What are you?
Oh, I'm a Taurus Sun, Taurus Moon, Gemini Rising.
I'm also a Gemini Rising. Funny, funny.
Yeah.
I always get along well with Tauruses and other Gemini Risings.
And I always crush on fire signs. It's like really, really real in my life. It's so real.
I do not envy you that position.
They're just burning, you know, like they're just, whoo. Yeah.
No. I had too many Leos in my family.
Love me a Leo. Yeah. Yeah. Particularly Aries and Sagittarius for me, I will admit. The rest of my life, I have been unlearning. I mean, that picks up on the Eve. Picks up on just so many threads throughout your book. And I know I have you for unlimited time this morning, so I'm going to move us into, yeah, thinking about new community formations and polyformations. And I think a lot about intimate community formations, which is so queer, and it is so anti everything, you know, the way I grew up in the church, how we were supposed to think about like marriage is between a man and a woman and blah, blah, blah. And like, and it's, you're so fenced, you're so kept in. And for me, the like, the incredible agency and the selfhood of learning that your intimate community, like your intimate communities are many, not one. And I loved that in the back of your book. First of all, I loved your notes section, and I love the kind of honor you do about where your forms come from, and they're rooted in community for you and students. And I loved seeing that. And you also have a photo that you took in Barcelona of a sculpture, an altarpiece
excuse me. And I find it a really complex altar piece, and it's a figuration of Adam and Eve on either side, and then the serpent woman figure in the center with the flower above them. And you wrote, "After I saw the work, I knew that it wasn't fruit that Eve claimed. It was her agency, her desire for another woman." And I will just say that when you read book 6 with the final lines, "God made man in his own image, so they say, I made a beloved in mine." I guess this podcast is going to have to be marked explicit, because that's when I wrote, and that was the first time in your book I wrote "fuck yes" next to my little marginalia, you know? And I thought, I paused and I was like, yeah, that first moment you write "fuck yes" next to someone's poem in a book, that's a real moment,
right? Well, yeah. First of all, I'm honored for the "fuck yes." You can write "fuck yes" anywhere in my book, and I will be the blushiest, happiest person in the world. I mean, for me, it is, you know, this collection. I mean, you said this so beautifully, and I hadn't thought about it in this way, but when you said "the rest of my life, I have been unlearning," in some ways, this is a book about unlearning a lot of the internalized ideas I had about gender, sexuality, social structures, family. I know you were talking, you mentioned like alternative communities. I believe you even mentioned polyamory. Did you mention polyamory? So yeah, I mean, I have a very non-traditional family and live with my partner and her co-parent. So that's my really amazing, wonderful house, and we're very much happy. And I think, like, you know, I think a lot of this had to be lived to get to the point of writing some of these poems, and also recognizing that, like, there isn't shame around sex, there isn't shame around desire, there isn't shame around wanting things that are outside of the norm, as long as you're not hurting somebody. Unless they ask for it. Jenny Johnson has been writing some pretty kinky poems, so I have those on the brain. If you haven't read "Fisting Party" on the Cortland Review by Jenny Johnson, or "Bottoms" on American Poetry Review by Jenny Johnson, I highly recommend those. But for me, it's really about, like, you know, trying to locate in my poems the places in which I am the most vulnerable to old patterns of influence, and trying to excise them. And in some ways, like, especially engaging with, like, mythic or biblical figures is a way for me to do that illustratively without having to necessarily examine it immediately in my own life. Was that a complete thought?
I mean, it's this, I love that feeling, like, this of poetry is a just a continual conversation among poets, and that we contribute and bring in. Like, I love that you brought in Jenny Johnson. That "Fisting Party" poem absolutely blew my mind. I was just like, and I'm so here for it. Like, you know, feeling like we kind of write to ourselves, to our self edges, right? And that's like an exploring place. And that's very exciting to me. And I've written more with, like, kink, and more with just toy, all kinds of things. And that's just, like, such a good, it feels such like an alive place to be. And I just think poetry is, like, it's about the living. It's here for us. It, like, nourishes us. It puts us in community. It, like, enriches us. It does things with knowledge and learning. And I make noises all the time. I drop things. I love that. Last episode with Catherine Rockwood, I was like, oh my God, I thumped my desk when you said something, because I was like, yes. And they were like, oh yeah, you know, it's the kitchen podcast. There's, like, the clinking of glasses. And that was really incredible. And I just, you know, more queer love poems, more, you know, Artemis Wears a Strap-On, like these just incredible.
I shared that poem for Valentine's Day.
Yes, I was really happy to see that. Because like we also learn, like there are models that we learn by. Wait, did you see that?
Yeah.
It's my tuxedo cat tux trying to get into the office. And I told my partner, I was like, please get her out. And she's insisting on being known and seen this morning, which like respect it's girl, okay. But.
Okay. So what were you saying? You're saying queer, write more queer love poems.
Yeah. And like our models for even just learning like that. I think like for queer people, our learning is often subversive. It also comes through different ways. We're not being handed it on a platter like we are lots of other forms of learning. I mean, whether it's sexuality in school, whether it's just mm-hmm. like, and I think that that's such an important work we do as readers and as queer readers. And mm-hmm. I think of people who've been really important to even like my queer knowing, like Carl Phillips, and mm-hmm. I think of you, you know, I just, there are lots of ways we're kind of held in community. Mm-hmm. And I love to see I also, because I brought up your poem, Artemis Wears a Strap-On, which if you would like to read, I would love to hear it. But I'm also thinking of, here, I'm going to blank, because I'm pausing over the pronunciation of their name. Donica Kelly, and I'm trying to remember if it's Danica Kelly or
I think it's Donica.
Donica, great. Okay, good.
Donica Kelly's poem, What Gay Porn Did for Me, which appears in Bestiary, and then Destiny O Birdsong has recently published a poem. I can't remember exactly where, it might be a Jorit journal, but don't quote me on that. What Lesbian Porn Has Done for Me. And that might have actually been on Academy American Poets. So like those kinds of things. I think of Zan Phillips's work. I really, really, really love The Book Hull, and also now I'm blanking on that poem name. This is literally COVID brain fog. I can never remember titles. Zan Phillips's poem, Want Could Kill Me, which is an excellent poem, and also love their work in Hull. Cam Awkward Rich's work, Ari Banez's work. These are all writers who are regularly influencing my own work and challenging me to face things more in a head-on way than I might have otherwise, especially internalizing some of those ideas about like we need to be subtle as poets. Well, no, we don't. So, I mean, I really don't know why. I mean, I think there's ways in which we can introduce subtext, but subtext, and my favorite way to introduce subtext is through the line break. Subtext is very different than being subtle or than circumlocuting something or being elliptical. And I think that there can be a lot of artfulness writing about identity as well. And that's something I hear, especially as a professor in the very flawed system of academia and higher education, that like poetry that is about identity is somehow less artful, that it's just journalistic, that we're speaking about who we are rather than actually employing like craft techniques to also render that. And I think, you know, ways we make poetry, we make meaning out of poetry is just, they're so manifold. I mean, we make it through the line, we make it through what's literally said in the sentence, we make it through the visual representation on the page, which I would call format, but it could also be form if it's a received form. It can come through sounds, so sonic devices. It can come through the pacing of the poem. So we have so many ways to kind of create meaning in poems. And sometimes when you're writing about identity, you're working in this space of like five of those. And then if you have like one blanket statement that's just an outright expository statement, then everybody's like, that's not artful. But sometimes you need to just say things. And I'll also plug another poet, Chen Chen. Several years ago, we were faculty members at a LGBTQ writers retreat for Sundress Publications. And can I just also side note, I was not out when I was invited to this. And I just was like, good job, guys. Like, you clocked it. But Chen gave this great, great talk on the art of telling and why it is so important to sometimes just say something plainly, in addition to also sometimes saying things in, you know, through more artifice. And I know we've been talking about artifice a lot, but artifice isn't necessarily bad, but it's not always the mode that you need to be working in. I'm rambling now.
No, that was incredible. And real, like, and what poets can say and what poets can't say, like, there's a lot of self-censorship that goes on, and a lot of, I think, self-permission is something I talk to writers a lot about, and it's always like a little lecture to myself as well whenever I'm like, don't self-censor yourself, don't self-reject yourself. And it's so, I mean, I love the line, the striptease of knowledge in the very first book of Yifo, knowledge stripteasing like a poppy, because like knowledge itself to me is so queer and expansive. And it's like, who wants to shut down knowledge? Who wants to limit and delimit and, you know, keep and protect and gatekeep? And queerness is so opposed to all of that for me. I think I just find poetry inherently very queer too, itself. And it was weird for me on Valentine's Day to see so many posts that were just about one person. And like, that's good and beautiful too. I'm not against like couples, but I don't know. It's like Valentine's is also something I celebrate with like my children. And it's also like, and it's just like that there are lots of different, I don't know. I find the like two romantic love thing is not where I'm at. And so I'm really appreciative of like the poets that are just doing so much more in their work and inviting so much in. And yeah. And it's like, it can be a poem like Donica Kelly's Centaur. That's like, oh, so yeah, about metaphor. Oh my God. Like, it's so about metaphor. It's so about sound. It's so about like power. And it's just like, oh, gorgeous. And I think people are often scared of graphicness or scared of just saying something. You know, like, oh, did I say that out loud? And so you can do incredible things with metaphor if you're like a young queer poet, if you're like really exploring this for the first time, or you're thinking about your gender, or like that there are many, many ways to do it, right? Many formations.
And Natalie D has a poem in Postcolonial Love that is just stunningly rich and velvety. And once again, long COVID brain fog, I do not have the title offhand off in my brain, so I can send that to you. But I'm stunned also when there's a physicality to poetry that feels so close to my own kind of like sense of embodied reality as a queer person. And I think that the ways that we have access to render embodied experiences are also manifold, in the sense of like sound can be a great kind of synesthetic vehicle for like metamorphosing something that's in language into a felt bodily experience. That happens also through the visual relationship of the poem on the page, or through the line break and things like that. And so I think, you know, especially as I'm moving into working on both, been working on for a million years, but it takes up queerness in a pretty grand scale. And then also my next book of poems, I'm very, very interested in attempting to kind of synesthetically or impressionistically engage that embodied experience of queerness and how fluid that can be as well. And so, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm full of every gender, and sometimes I feel like I have no gender, or and other times I feel like there's just an Amelia gender. and I think like being able to capture the ways in which those shift and change and move is kind of my next project on the page. And I think I needed to write the poems of this book to kind of, you know, assess what's actually happening in terms of like what my brain does when I start to formulate some idea of gender. And then I go, oh wait, like, where did that come from? But ultimately, I hope that the book is also celebratory, and it's why there's this kind of movement toward the end and in the third section about like being kind of ecstatic to be kind of outside of the norm. And that really comes through in the title poem. Also, the Artemis Wears a Pom Pom, which I'm happy to read. See how I brought that back.
That'd be incredible. And I love that we touched on so many love poems, and I'm going to make sure all of them out there in the show notes for readers.
Oh, yay. Okay. Artemis wears a strap on. Chariot, I am, and six golden antlered stags. Legs fuzzed above the knee, below bee stingers and shaven. Hands a clamor, I'm a gentle archer. Breasts like knots and rope, a purple scar in my thigh meat. I'll make your heart beat like all four hooves left the ground, returning, and kiss your ankles, walnuts held in a cheek. What is godlike in you, I'll godden, sudden as slag and heat. You, my dogs howling, you, my captive capturing. Thumb on the golden raisin until a navel thwang of bowstring. My quiver is never empty. Your kisses like poppies petaling. Ruin is what stands the longest. Wonder me.
Thank you so much, Amelia. Thank you for being on the show.
And thank you, Han.
Gift of your presence. And I think there are so many people who miss you and will be really happy to hear your voice and your poems. And congratulations on Non-Binary Bird of Paradise. It's incredible.
Well, congratulations on your, how many downloads was it? 10,000?
10,000.
Congratulations on your 10,000 downloads.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to episode 46 of Poetry Podcast with the poet Amelia Phillips, who read from their new book, Non-Binary Bird of Paradise. You can find a link in the show notes to all the poems Amelia and I talked about, as well as Amelia's website, and you can purchase their new book. And thanks so much for joining us today.